I pay homage to the Buddha. I pay homage to the Dhamma. I pay homage to the Sangha. Back in 2002, a movie came out that was nearly universally hated by critics and also by moviegoers, except for maybe me and a few other people, called Kung Pao Enter the Fist. So I don't know if anyone's seen this ridiculous movie. It is bad, but for me it was so bad it was good. But if you don't know what the movie is, a filmmaker got the rights to an older Chinese kung fu movie. And what he decided to do was to blue screen himself into the movie as the protagonist, known as Chosen One, as his actual name. Most people just call him Chosen in the movie. And with the movie itself, he edited certain scenes, dubbed things ridiculously, created some new scenes as well, and just created a ridiculous and silly movie. And I remember knowing full well what people were already saying about the movie, that I was in for what was probably going to be a bad time. Like, it was not going to be a good movie. And I remember convincing my girlfriend at the time to go see it with me. And we enter into what was an empty theater, except for another couple sitting a few rows ahead of us. And we sit down, movie begins, and I am watching the movie, and I start laughing because I'm finding it funny. My girlfriend next to me also is laughing, and I think partially laughing just because I'm laughing. Like, I'm laughing so loud that she's shocked and is laughing too. But the couple a few rows ahead of us are dead silent. Not a sound coming from them. And about 35 to 40 minutes in, maybe even a little less, they just quietly get up and leave the theater. And then it's just my girlfriend and me watching this terrible, so bad it's good movie. Now, the thing is about this movie, I believe the criticism of it. I think even today on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a score of like 13%. Something like that. But I will say that I went into the movie already a huge fan of 70s and 80s martial arts films as they had been brought to the United States. And if you don't know much about that history, what happened is Americans got hold of some of these movies, knew they'd be a hit in the United States because of the action, but otherwise really didn't care so much about stuff like plot or translation or getting anything right. And so what they often did was they'd get a room of guys, just anyone really, to do the voiceover, the dubbing of the movie, without a script. They had no idea. They would just watch and then just sort of figure out what the scene was about and come up with some lines. Didn't really matter what the lines were. They just needed lines so they could put this out. And so if you're a connoisseur of those kind of movies, you recognize that, like, yeah, nothing makes any sense. The plot is so not the point, and it's just ridiculous and acted very badly because you have not professional voice actors just giving voice to these characters. And so this movie, Kung Pao, was in much a way a send-up to that. It's dubbed poorly. Nothing matches the actors' mouths. There's even one scene where a dog barks silently, and then you hear the sound as the dog is lying down. Just really, really bad stuff like that. So I went into the movie already familiar with the fact that this was a part of a larger conversation. This was someone who was a big fan of 70s and 80s poorly dubbed kung fu movies. Someone else who went into it expecting something more like The Matrix or even Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon would have been sorely disappointed by what this dumb movie was. Now, I'm not saying that knowing that full conversation makes the movie better. You might be fully conversant in the conversation and still think it's really bad. In fact, these days, now that I'm not so juvenile in my sense of humor, that's kind of where I am. I understand what it was getting at. It's still a terrible movie. Please don't watch it if you haven't. But I bring all this up to highlight the idea of knowing a conversation as you enter into it, which I think is important for us as Buddhists, because I think that as we are discovering and shaping Buddhism in the West, here in the United States in particular, we're oftentimes a part of a larger conversation that's been going on for a long time, and we often don't know that that's what's happening, right? So, silly way to start what's otherwise a very serious conversation, but it highlights something important, that Buddhism has been a conversation that's been happening for roughly 2,600 years, not something freshly discovered. And what that means is that when we learn something about Buddhism, it's helpful to have someone along the way who can point out the fact that this is something that's been changing and shifting, and it's been in dialogue. This has been important for me because as I've been learning to be a scholar of not just Buddhism, but Indian religions in general, it's been quite eye-opening to see how the various things that in the West are just sort of taken for granted as like, oh, for sure, this is 100%, you know, original taste Buddhism, is really something that has shifted and moved because of conversation. As an example, one of the things I want to talk about today, in particular, I think, is this idea that, you know, Buddhism is really about blank. When you get down to it, Buddhism is just blank. And in the West, we often receive certain messages depending on which kind of Buddhism we come across. If we go into the Vipassana insight realm, we tend to hear that Buddhism is really just about mindfulness. Buddhism is really just about insight. Buddhism is just about something like that. And if we end up more in the Mahayana realm in the US, that's usually more of like the Zen type, we end up coming across, well, you know, Buddhism is really about seeing things as they really are. There's this flavor of non-duality, that the issue that we have at hand is that when we're looking at the world, we're having all these concepts, and you want to cut right through all those concepts and see things without any discursive thought, just seeing things in their natural state. And that's one of the things that we receive in the West when we learn Buddhism from those traditions. Now that I've spent more time studying Indian religions and seeing the way the conversation has gone, I can hear those things and see why they've come to be. It's important to remember that in the history of Buddhism, at a certain point, Buddhism went from being a path leading to liberation to being just another one of the religions in India, which I think is something really important to keep in mind. You know, these days we might find teachers that rightly point out that Buddhism is about liberation. Buddhism is about awakening. But there was a time, a good chunk of Buddhist history, where that got forgotten. In fact, there were a lot of teachers and a lot of scholars that taught that the time of the Arahants was over, that there was no chance of being awakened, of becoming an Arahant, becoming enlightened. And so the narrative shifted. Then it was really not pointing out how this leads to liberation. It was more just pointing out how this religion is better than the other religions. And so you have a lot of polemic and sectarian argumentation that starts coming up. You have people arguing for beliefs rather than arguing in regard to something higher. To put it in a philosophical Western context, you have those that were philosophers really trying to get down to the heart of things. And you had sophists that got busy arguing just for the sake of arguing. And so you have this kind of sophism that forms in like the 5th, 6th century of Buddhism. And that becomes part of the dialogue, where Buddhism shifts and moves away from learning how to understand the heart and understand the mind, and becomes ways of categorizing the world and defining ontologically what the world is. It just becomes a philosophy with sophistic elements, argumentation, Basically, Buddhists became apologists, trying to show why their religion was better than the other religions that they were surrounded by. A lot of this idea of seeing things the way they are, to me at this point, when I look at it, has a lot of the hallmarks of some of the other traditions that I've been studying now, such as the yoga tradition, such as the Vedanta tradition. This idea that the world itself is illusory. There's this Maya sort of working around, and we have this illusory world that's tricking us all the time. We're looking at it and we're seeing all these things, and the way out, the moksha or liberation, is being able to pierce through and see the illusion for what it is. I would say that when we start going back to the suttas that we have in the Pali Canon, the conversation ends up being quite different. It's not so much about the way the world is, it's about how the heart is, how the mind is. It's not that the world is an illusion, it's that the mind is deluded, which is a very different emphasis. And so for those of us in the West, and myself included, I remember being a young Buddhist, and I would learn various phrases and I would commit them to memory, including something like seeing things as they are. In fact, the term, as I'll discuss later, has had different translations, including not just seeing things the way they are, but seeing things in conformity with the truth, and various other stronger claims about the reality of the world itself, rather than looking at the heart and mind. And those are the kind of things that I would take on and just think, yep, that's it, and I wouldn't question it. Which is so funny, because one of the big things that Buddhists today in the United States love to talk about is the Kalama Sutta, the sutta that says that we should be inquiring, that we should ask questions, that we should investigate, that we should be curious. But then the majority of the time, we hear something like that and go, yep, that sounds good, and then just check it off the list. Buddhist wisdom. Seeing things as they are. And thinking that that in itself is end, right? Not a mean. It is an end to see things as they are. You know, well, what Buddhism is really about is seeing things as they are, which is not the conversation at all, at least in the Pali Canon. So to highlight that, I want to share a particular sutta today that shows that particular phrase translated differently. In Pali, this phrase is yata bhuta jnana dasana, or dasanam, right? Which means, the way I would translate it, the way my teacher translates it as well, is knowledge and vision of things as they have come to be. And it is not an end in itself, but part of a greater system that I will not go into in depth today. I think it'll be just enough to show that it is a means and not an end, and to point out what the end is. So, as I said, this comes from the Pali Canon. This comes from, in particular, the Anguttara Nikaya. And this is in the Book of Elevens. In fact, it's the very first one. And so the translated title of this sutta is, What is the Purpose? And so in this sutta, the Buddha is sitting in Sabati, in Jetta's Grove, and Ananda is there with him. Ananda is the Buddha's attendant. And so Ananda asks the Buddha a simple question, really, at least he thinks so at first. What is the purpose of skillful virtues? What is their reward? And a discussion takes place where, in each case, the Buddha is pointing out the purpose and the reward, going higher and higher still to the very end of what the Buddha teaches. And towards the end, he gives a summary so that I'm not reading the whole thing to you. He says, Thus, in this way, Ananda, skillful virtues have freedom from remorse as their purpose, freedom from remorse as their reward. Freedom from remorse has joy as its purpose, joy as its reward. Joy has rapture as its purpose, rapture as its reward. Rapture has calm as its purpose, calm as its reward. Calm has pleasure as its purpose, pleasure as its reward. Pleasure has concentration as its purpose, concentration as its reward. Concentration has knowledge and vision of things as they have come to be as its purpose, knowledge and vision of things as they have come to be as its reward. Knowledge and vision of things as they have come to be has disenchantment as its purpose, disenchantment as its reward. Disenchantment has dispassion as its purpose, dispassion as its reward. Dispassion has knowledge and vision of release as its purpose, knowledge and vision of release as its reward. In this way, Ananda, skillful virtues lead step by step to the consummation of arahantship. And so I'll point out at first here the idea of knowledge and vision, jnana dasana in Pali, meaning here not just a seeing, but a knowing, not just a knowing, but an experiencing. And so he says it here in two regards, really having an experience, an experiential knowledge of things as they have come to be, and ultimately the end of Buddhism, its goal, its purpose, knowledge and vision, experiential wisdom of release itself. Release being the reason why we practice, the reason why we develop, the reason why we cultivate. Getting back to the very thing that the Buddha said was what he taught. He would say so many times in so many suttas, in the past and now, I proclaim suffering and the end of suffering. That's what he taught. That's what it was the purpose behind everything that he shared in terms of the Dhamma. And so we see it here even in this system. So knowledge and vision in reference to things as they have come to be, and as the goal, knowledge and vision of release. But you'll notice that even in terms of what has come to be, it's in the middle of this system that has very little to do with the outside world, except for that very first part, that part that we usually classify as sila, our conduct. And the Buddha says that the reason why we have skillful action is because it gives us freedom from remorse. And so if we think of the Buddhist system as one that has meditation as a big part of the practice, I've referenced this in the past, we have this way of gladdening the mind. And so one of the ways that we can gladden the mind is by reflecting on our good actions, reflecting on the good that we've done, knowing that we've been skillful in our day so that when we do sit down to meditate, we do so having that freedom from remorse. We can sit down and go, okay, I've been skillful today, and now I can do this other work of looking into my heart and mind. And all of the other qualities have their references in other passages when the Buddha is talking about how we meditate skillfully, how we practice, say, anapanasati, developing joy, developing rapture or refreshment is another way of translating it, having this sense of calm as we settle our bodily actions, settle our mental activity, as we really focus in on concentration. We can see a whole system here with release as its goal. And I'm not quite sure exactly when the shift in Buddhism happened, because as a historian of Buddhist religions, I can't say for sure this is when it went off, only to see that it has developed over the course of centuries, that it became a philosophy very much concerned with how the world is, which is strange to me given how many times we have in the canon, both, and I use the Pali canon, but they also exist in the Chinese canon as the Agamas, as the early texts they have in their traditions that also say the same stuff. That we're practicing for release, that a lot of these ontological and philosophical concerns that other traditions, other philosophies, other religions want to debate in are not what the Buddha wanted to debate in. In fact, the Buddha very rarely wanted to debate. He wanted to get down to what he called a handful of leaves. He wanted to get to the stuff that really concerns us and can really make a difference in our lives, which is the activity happening inside. Which is why even when we look at passages like this, it starts from the outside It starts with our actions out in the world, but every single point, that means that 10 out of the 11 are about looking inward and seeing what's happening in here and developing certain qualities and developing those qualities to a particular end, release itself. So I don't know what that means for us in the West as Buddhists to bring this up. Partially because sometimes it isn't received well to point that out. I know that in some cases, people don't find it philosophically satisfying that they have to set aside those other questions. They want to have those ontological and cosmological conversations. They want to have that deep philosophical discussion. They want to know, like, yeah, but what is the really real? And for a while there, especially as I've been studying on my working on my PhD, I was thinking, okay, well, maybe this is just a scholastic concern. Maybe these are scholars that just have this concern with what is really real. But the fact of the matter is that what happens in the academic world often tends to trickle into what's experienced for those practicing. And so even in my discussion with other Buddhists, there does tend to be this desire to talk about what's really real, to talk about the world and its illusions and how it plays out and all these other things. And the inner work wants to kind of be set aside, minimized, and sometimes ignored. So I know I started out in such a silly way bringing up this movie that I did. But I will say that I enjoyed the movie more having known the conversation it was trying to have. And I truly think that for us as Buddhists, I think that we have a greater chance of really developing when we have the conversation that's been going on in Buddhism in our minds as well. To understand that what we learn from various teachers today are often things that they learned from their teachers, and they learned from their teachers. And in some cases, those things haven't been questioned. And so it behooves all of us to do some of those questions, do some of that questioning ourselves, if others have not. And so this isn't something that I'm just doing, it's also something that I encourage all of you to do as well, which is to look at what's been received here in the West in terms of Buddhism, and to really ask yourself, okay, how is this immediately applicable to my own stress and pain now? How is this immediately applicable to my own suffering right here and right now? And how does it help me find release? And we can look at lists like this, and we don't have to memorize all of it, but understand the kind of qualities that the Buddha found worthwhile for us to develop. The fact that it's not concerned with the outside, but concerned with our hearts. How much joy do we have? How much happiness do we have? How much calm do we have? And can we develop these things in such a way that we're able to understand how they even form in the mind in the first place? To really have experiential knowledge of these qualities and how they can develop so well that they can lead and point us to release, freedom, nibbana, cessation, which the Buddha described as ultimate happiness, ultimate peace, ultimate calm, the ultimate goal for all of us who are trying to unburden ourselves. So I think that's enough for today. Thank you very much for listening to this talk. I hope that it was helpful in some way to you and your practice. May you be well.